Good morning. I'm Greg Henriksen, your moderator for today, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest, Dr. Roseanne Leipzig. Before we get started, I'd like to thank today's musicians, Fireside Winds, for providing the music many of you have enjoyed while waiting for the presentation to begin. And also, thank you to River Mead for generously sponsoring today's event, and for the Monadnock Community Hospital for Flowers. For many years, the Summer Lyceum has brought outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. Today's talk is being recorded and will soon be available as a podcast and as a video on our website, monadnocklyceum.org. Programs are rebroadcast on WSMN 1590 AM the following Sunday at 10 AM and on WUML 91.5 FM on the following Wednesday at 11 a.m. and the following Sunday at 3 p.m. As is the tradition at the Lyceum, after the presentation, our speaker will answer questions from the audience. Those present here may write your comments on the yellow card in the pew in front of you, and an usher will come around to collect those. For those watching virtually, please submit your questions by using the live comments section on Facebook or YouTube, or send them to our email, monlyceum@gmail.com. The Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the glass bowls in the church and in the parish hall. Those listening at home may make contributions on our website or by mailing your donation. Thank you for your generous support. Those of you who came to the hall this morning will find a green card in the pew. We hope you'll give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list and our email list. You can either mail the card to us or drop it in the bowls along or with your contribution to the sustainability of the Lyceum. For those watching virtually, you may provide feedback on today's program, suggestions for next summer's speakers, make a donation, or join our mailing list through the website. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through the door to your left. There you'll have an opportunity to engage further in further conversation with our speaker and enjoy refreshments. Since this is an especially hot day, for those of you who may need water or want water during the course of the presentation, just raise your hand and someone will bring you some water. Our speaker today is Roseanne Leipzig. It's a particular pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Leipzig. She and I are colleagues at the Department of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City. Dr. Leipzig is a professor and emerita vice chair for education in our department. She's had a major hand in the creation of the field of geriatrics and is the recipient of many honors and awards from professional organizations and community groups. Dr. Leipzig has published numerous professional articles and edits a monthly newsletter for health consumers focused on healthy aging. Many of us are eagerly anticipating her book for the general public, Honest Aging, which should be out this year. Roseanne and I have known each other for much of our professional careers. We worked together in the 1980s in Hillside Hospital, Long Island Jewish Medical Center, And in a stroke of good fortune, I joined her department 9 years ago, during which time we've collaborated on many projects. For those of you who might know a few words of Yiddish, Roseanne is a real mensch. She's one of the nicest people I know, and I always feel better after having a meeting with her. We are blessed to work in a department that is also populated by especially dedicated and kind colleagues. Roseanne and I have grown into older adulthood together. At a recent geriatrics meeting, one of the speakers, Riley, commented, "We've been working on the elderly so long, we are the elderly." She has a lot to say about aging, both its upsides and downsides. And today, I'm sure you'll appreciate hearing from her as she talks honestly about what she has learned about aging and her experience of serving older people as a physician.
Thank you, Greg. My mother would love that. So, welcome to everybody. This is quite an interesting perch to be seeing you all from. I'm very glad you invited me, and I feel very lucky to be in this beautiful place and to have heard such wonderful music to get all of us in the mood. So I want to start with some, first of all, I want the people in the back, if you can't hear me, to raise your hands, okay, because I know there's some fans and things going on. I will speak louder. Is that better? Okay. I tend to speak softly and carry a large stick. So I want to start with some definitions for the title of this talk so we're all on the same page. The talk is, what is the right medical care for older adults? So let's start with, who's an older adult? When I was in my 30s doing my fellowship, my major professor had a big 50th birthday party. And I remember thinking, oh my God, how can he be that old? Now when I get invited to a 50th birthday party, I think, how can they be that young? Your perspective changes as you age. Bernard Baruch, the great statesman, defined old age as anyone who's 15 or more years older than I am. And that works for me. What's the right medical care? My definition for medical care is the right medical care depends on who you are and what your priorities are. The purpose is to make your medical care better aligned with your personal definition of health. Remember, your medical care is in service to you. Now, this is true at any age, but as we get older, it becomes more true. The older we are, the more medical tests, procedures, treatments are offered by our providers, by our families, suggested by our friends, they're on TV, they're in internet ads. Which of these are necessary? Again, necessary depends on what you want from your medical care. Many divide this into quantity or length of life versus quality of life. But for most of us, it's really much more complex than this. And it changes as our circumstances change. As a geriatrician, I've provided medical care to thousands of older adults and their loved ones. So what have I learned from them? That by accepting reality, learning what to expect as you age, and the ways in which you can adapt to this new normal you find yourself in, you can have a life where your activities and healthcare are in sync with what really matters to you. I hope that by the end of the hour, you'll be able to envision, embrace, and prepare for your own aging, as well as to be an advocate for the older people in your lives. So what I'd like to do in the next 40 minutes is, first of all, to provide you with a reality check on what to expect during your old age and how to adapt to your new normal. And secondly, to provide you with a framework on how to decide what medical care makes sense for you as you grow older, and if you find your health and medical care becoming a burden, or if you are approaching the end of your life. So before we start, I'd like to know who's in the room, who's online. If you would raise your hand if you are less than 30 years old. Just checking. If you're between 30 and 49. If you're between 50 and 65. My hands are going up, okay. Between 66 and 80. Lots of hands are up. How about over 80? Good. Everybody's represented. Now, raise your hand if you're lying about your age. And if you are, let us know if you're making yourself older or younger. So you received a paper. Hopefully those online will see it on your screen. But in your, what's it called? Program. Thank you. And it has a bunch of questions on it. And these are the reality check questions. And we're going to go through them one by one. And what I want you to do is just look at what the numbers are that I'm offering you so you have an idea when we get there, okay? So the first question asks what ages you think people live to. And we're going to use the concept of median life expectancy. This is the age to which half of people who've attained a given age will live past, and half of people will die before. So there's a median life expectancy at every age. So I just want you to shout out to me what you think in this country the median life expectancy is at birth. 78, 65, 85. Okay, we're all over the place, right? It's actually 78, okay? Maybe getting to 79. We're not the highest in the world. How about if you make it to 65? What's the median life expectancy if you make it to 65? 85, 80? Okay, you're in the neighborhood. It's 84, okay? I round with interns and residents at the hospital, and every time I do that, I ask them this question. And there's always one or two of them who tell me median life expectancy for somebody who's 65 is 70. And I tell them they got to get out of the hospital more. Because all they're seeing are the people who are most vulnerable and most sick, and that is not representative of the population. So how about if you make it to 85? What's median life expectancy? 95, 92. 92 is correct, okay? And men, this is where your life expectancy starts to equal that of women. Women have had a longer life expectancy up until that point. And what if you get on the Today Show? I think they're still doing this. And you're a centenarian. You've made it to 100. What's median life expectancy? I'm hearing everything. 101, 105, 100 in a month. Okay. It's actually 2.5 more years. It's 102.5. The take home, the longer you live, the longer you're going to live. Okay? So that's how long we can expect to live. But how about how well? So I'm going to ask you to raise your hand for the answer as I shout out, as I give you the percentage for each of these questions. So what is the percent of people over 85 who report that their health is good or excellent? 10%? 30%? A few, okay. 50%? A lot more. 70%? We're going down again. 90%? We're kind of back at 10%, okay. The answer is actually 70%. And the truth is, when somebody says their health is good or excellent, it usually is. If they tell you it's poor or fair, it's usually poor or fair. People have a good sense of this. How about the percent of people over 85 who have significant limitations in their vision, hearing, mobility, communication, cognition, or self-care? Again, over 85. 10%? Got a couple of takers. 20%? A few more takers. 30%? Starting to go up. 40%? Much more? 50%. Okay, so between 40 and 50%. And you're right, it's about 40%. And for those people who are over 65, it's 20%. Okay, and we'll talk more about what you can do about that. How about the percent of people over 85 who are living with dementia? Is it 10%? One or two hands? 20%? A few more hands? 35%? Lots more hands? 50%? Okay, coming back down, 60%. Okay. So the answer to this question depends on the year you asked the question. If you asked the question in 1986, it was 30%. If you asked the question in 2010, which is the last year we have decent data, it was 21.7%. So in 24 years, the percentage of people 85 and older who were living with dementia declined almost 30%. That's pretty incredible. Take a moment to think about that. So why? Well, one reason is we're better educated. We start at a higher level, and it takes a bit longer until you get down to the point where changes in memory and cognition affect your everyday life, which is the definition of dementia. And the second is there are a lot fewer strokes than there used to be. There's also fewer heart attacks than there used to be. Many of us can remember that it was not uncommon for 40 and 50-year-old men to drop dead. Okay, I remember this very much from growing up. It doesn't happen anymore when people have had medical care. There really have been advances. So there are fewer strokes, fewer heart attacks. So the take-home point, keep your heart healthy. Heart health is brain health. It's also sexual health. Having good heart health can maintain your arousal and your function. Okay? Now let's talk about the percent of people who are over 85 who are frail. Again, we need a definition here, right, for frailty? So frailty is a decrease in physiologic reserves that makes it hard to overcome illness and other stressors. Okay? Do you remember Justice Potter Stewart? Yeah, he was one of the Supreme Court justices a while ago. He was asked to define obscenity. And he said he couldn't define it, but he knew it when he saw it. Okay? Many people think that's the definition of frailty. They can't define it, but they know it when they see it. Well, the truth of the matter is, probably when you see somebody that you think is frail, they probably are frail. But in our world right now, we have a lot of older people who are frail, but obese. And because they're overweight, the extra fat has gotten into their muscles and made them weaker than you would expect for someone their size. Okay? So let me tell you one of the definitions that's used commonly for frailty. And I want you to think about someone. It may be yourself. It may be your mother. It may be your neighbor. And think about how many of these points that person would get. Okay? Five points. The first is an unintentional weight loss of 5% or more of their body weight, or an unintentional 10-pound weight loss over the past year. The second is weak grip strength. The third is exhaustion, a self-report that everything is an effort, that they just couldn't get going for more than 3 days a week for a month or so. The fourth is a very slow walking speed. Now, everybody, as they get older, walks more slowly. That's just part of what happens, lots of reasons for it. But this is being in the bottom fifth of what that walking speed is, okay? And the last one is a low activity level, which many of us had for the past 2 years, right? We became couch potatoes during COVID. And during that time, when you have low activity, you become more and more deconditioned, and it becomes harder and harder to do your everyday activities. So how do we score this? If somebody hits 4 or 5 of these points, they're considered frail. If they hit 0 to 1, they're considered fit. And if they hit 2 to 3, they're considered pre-frail, they could end up back at fit, they could end up at frail. So what are the percent of people over 85 who meet these definition criteria for frailty? Is it 5%? Hands? Nobody? 25%? Okay, some. 40%? More? 55%? Okay, coming down a bit. 70%. All right, the answer is 25%. Yeah, these are the data. Were you surprised? Let me summarize. Most older people, even those 85 and older, are doing okay. For those 85 and older, 70% say their health is excellent or good. 60% don't have significant limitations in their vision, their hearing, their mobility, their communication, cognition, or self-care. And for those who do, there are ways to adapt and improve these concerns. 80% don't have dementia, and 75% are not frail. So that's right-sizing our expectations at this point, okay? So what's the right medical care for you as you age? For most of us, it's care that is likely to help us keep doing what makes life meaningful for us. For each type of care, this depends on lots of different factors, but one really important one is your frailty status. Frailty and pre-frailty are more predictive of falls, acute confusion, and bad outcomes from hospitalizations than your actual or chronologic age. And each has a major influence on your medical care. So I'm going to illustrate this concept to you by telling you about three of my patients and how I think about their medical care. Rose is 90 years old. She considers her health excellent, and it has been. She's upset because she's developed high blood pressure, and that upset went away when I explained to her that 90% of 90-year-olds have high blood pressure. Okay? Now, that means it's normal, but it's not good for you. And if we decrease that blood pressure, you will have a 30% decrease in strokes and in heart failure. So it's certainly worth treating. She has a great chance of making it to 100, which she wants to do because she's got 6 great-grandchildren. And she wants to see them grow up as much as she can. Rose is fit. She's chronologically old. She's 90. And functionally, she's doing well. Her medical care should be standard, modified for age, and we'll talk about that a little bit in a few minutes, and based on what matters most to her. Letitia is not as lucky. She's 78. She's had diabetes for 40 years. She has poor vision from her diabetes, and she was a smoker. She has COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, from smoking. And on top of all of this, this year, she developed new rheumatoid arthritis, which along with her COPD really slows down her walking. Currently, she's in pain. She's having difficulty opening jars or picking things up with her hands. She's depressed and she's scared. Letitia's biologically older than Rose, but she's pre-frail. And she's at risk of developing further disability. You know, she's only 78. Rose was 90. Her medical care needs to help her adapt to her new normal. Needs to treat her pain and her depression, have her work with a low vision specialist, an occupational therapist, physical therapist, to improve her ability to see, to get information, and to provide her with therapy and devices to help her do her daily activities as independently as she possibly can. Nancy also just turned 90. She's living with mild dementia. She gets around with a cane. She also has COPD. She lives alone. She's got a really strong social network that helps her out, but her closest relative is in Maine. Recently, she had a 10-pound weight loss, and she can't walk as far as she used to without having shortness of breath. Very troubling. She doesn't know what medication she's been taking. Okay. So Nancy is frail. She's had a significant loss of ability. She doesn't have the reserves to compensate for stressors. And as opposed to Rose, who's also 90, Nancy's highly unlikely to make it to 100. And truthfully, she's told me she doesn't want to. Okay? So what matters most to Nancy? She wants to be able to connect with her friends and family. She wants to be able to meet her friends in the nearby park and get to her religious services weekly. So what did we do? We got her physical therapy. We found a pharmacy where her medications could be packaged into blister packs, or all of them to be taken at one time or in the pack, and she would take this twice a day. And we had the visiting nurse service come in to monitor her medication use, to teach her how to properly use her inhaler so she gets all the medication in each dose. She does that. And to provide a home aide who comes in a few days a week to help her with cleaning and taking a walk to the park to see her friends. If she's not able to get to the park and to services more often, we'll have to revise the plan and possibly reconsider her goals into something that's more achievable for her. Whether you're like Rose, Letitia, or Nancy, the key to aging well is to accept and adapt to your new normal. This is not always easy. Letitia may need to better understand the purpose of the antidepressant medication, and Nancy may need reminders to take her pills that are in the blister packs. But there are usually things that you can do to adapt if you let yourself be open to the new ways of doing things. It doesn't help to be an ostrich with your head in the sand, denying that you're experiencing changes as you age, which we all are, or to be intransigent, saying no to all suggestions that might help. You need to allow yourself to be creative and flexible, and at times to let go of long-standing beliefs or work on developing new habits. Let me give you a couple of examples. Many of my patients refuse to try hearing aids because they don't want to look old. Really? You think you look with it if you can't participate in the conversations or you're constantly asking people to repeat themselves? Every young person I see on the streets of New York, at least, has something in or sticking out of their ears. I keep saying this generation is going to have no trouble with hearing aids, especially if they're designed to look like the earbuds. You may not realize it, but hearing aids also help with memory. If you don't hear something, you can't remember it, okay? And there are studies that show that people with hearing problems are more likely to develop dementia, and we just don't know yet whether wearing hearing aids will help with that or not. I found for myself, I got my hearing aids at 60, and what I found was that they really decreased the cognitive burden. I was spending so much energy trying to understand what was being said to me that when I got the hearing aids in, I had all this energy left to do other things, okay? Give them a try. There's at least a 30-day full refund guarantee in most states because they are expensive. And now they're over-the-counter hearing aids at a lower price. This is new. We still don't know which are the best. I expect Consumer Reports will tell us soon, but it's worth it. It may be worth a try. To paraphrase that old commercial, try it, you might like it. Another example of adapting to your new normal, you know those commercials, gotta go, gotta go? They're everywhere, right? And what they're talking about is somebody needing to urgently get to the bathroom. This is something we don't talk about a lot. But the feeling of urge is due to uninhibited bladder contractions, and these increase with age. Now, when you were a toddler, you were toilet trained, and you learned how to suppress these urges. But as you get older, many things happen that bring them back. And this, as you well know, affects people's willingness to leave the house or to socialize. The urge is actually a wave that peaks and declines. And there are techniques like Kegel exercises and urge suppression that can help. So I tell my patients, when they feel the urge, freeze and squeeze. Stop, do a couple of quick Kegel contractions, and then distract yourself and wait until the urge leaves. You'll find that you can usually walk over to the bathroom without losing urine. As one of my colleagues says, it's mind over bladder. Whatever your new normal, find out what your options are. and let yourself think outside the box and develop new habits to adapt to that new normal. So now I'd like to move from how to adapt to your new normal to thinking about a framework for how to consider what's the right medical care for you. And there are three areas I want to discuss: prevention, preventive care, medication use, and making medical decisions. So when I'm discussing prevention and screening, I'm talking about those things like getting immunizations, treating high cholesterol, screening for cancer, screening for osteoporosis. And my advice to you is don't be a nihilist. Despite your age, the horse isn't out of the barn. So immunizations can actually prevent some infectious diseases. We certainly have learned this over the past few years. We in New York just had a case of polio, and it just shocked everybody. It's been so long. I mean, it really, when you think about what immunizations have done, it's incredible. It takes 2 to 4 weeks after you get that immunization, after you get the shot, until you have maximum protection. That's pretty quick, all right? And I'm now going to make a pitch for something. I don't usually do this, but it's an underutilized vaccine. It's the Shingrix vaccine to prevent shingles. And you should be getting it even if you had the first shingles vaccine, Zostavax, because it's 90% effective compared to the 40 to 50% for Zostavax. Why am I pushing this? I have no stock, okay? Shingles is common. You can get it more than once, and the pain can last for years in older adults. I've seen it totally change the course of more than one older adult life. It's 2 doses, 6 months apart. And just to note, although it's unusual, some people do get a short flu-like illness after the shot. This is actually more common in younger people and after the second shot. Another preventive measure that's effective at any age, quitting smoking. Within weeks, the risk of having a heart attack decreases, shortness of breath decreases, lung function improves. Within a year, your risk of a heart attack is cut in half. Okay? Getting a bone density study. Now, I personally don't get bone density studies because I'm a recurrent faller, and I didn't break anything yet, so I figure I'm okay. But there are many people who need a bone density study, and my doctor thinks I do. That'll tell you if you have osteoporosis. If you do, treatment will decrease your risk of fracture, including the dreaded hip fracture, okay? Within 1.5 to 2 years of treatment. So again, it's pretty good. Preventive medicine can provide benefits. But for screening tests in particular, there are a couple of things you need to consider that you probably didn't consider when you were younger. These are the things that you do reflexly or that your doctor recommends. You know, you probably have them written in your calendar. Get a mammogram, get a PSA, do a colonoscopy. So why think twice about screening and doing these things as you get older? Because screening doesn't prevent a disease from occurring. It detects disease that exists before you've had any signs or symptoms of the disease. And it can be years or even decades before the abnormality that's detected turns into something that will really affect you. For colon cancer, it's about 10 years. For prostate cancer, it's probably even longer. So some of my patients say, why not? It's just a blood test or an X-ray. But if the test is abnormal, then you get further diagnostic tests, scans, biopsies, and treatment recommendations like medication, chemotherapy, surgery, or radiation. Before you get screened, make sure you know what the next diagnostic and therapeutic test would be. And if you know you wouldn't do that, then don't get screened. It's hard for anyone to refuse treatment once they know they have cancer, no matter how little that cancer may be or how long it may take before it's going to cause suffering and death. Even if you don't want treatment, knowing that you have cancer can affect your quality of life. So just think twice. Everybody's different in this way. The second area I'd like to address is what medication use is right for you. So the Goldilocks approach is my way of looking at it. Not too much, not too little, just right for you. So the first question I would ask you is, do you need every medication you're taking? Because the more medications you take, the more likely it is that you'll have an adverse effect from that medication. Now, the benefit may still outweigh the risk, but it makes sense to regularly review with your primary care provider whether you still need to be taking each medication. There are some medications that should be avoided in older adults or used with caution, even if you've been taking them for a while. They cause more side effects as you get older. And if you should be taking them, ask if you should be taking a lower dose of them. Why a lower dose? Because as you get older, you become more sensitive to certain medications, particularly those that affect the brain. My way of thinking about it, a little facetiously, is as you age, you become a cheaper drunk. And some of you may have felt this already. It takes less alcohol to give you the effects you were looking for. While your usual amount causes more lightheadedness, worse balance, sleep problems, falls. And there are also changes in how the body handles drugs. For example, many older people need lower doses of insulin or thyroid medication. So you should take the lowest dose of a medication that does what it should be doing for you. And you can work with your doctor to go down and see if you have any, you lose the effectiveness of the drug and then you go back up again, okay? Also important to remember, especially in older adults, any new symptom can be due to a medication. The adverse effects may be different in older and younger people as well. So drugs that are currently available were not tested in many people before FDA approval, even if the largest audience for that drug was older people, okay? It was just a lot easier for them to do the trials with younger people. So arthritis, heart failure, it's really fairly amazing. This year, or last year, the National Institutes of Health stopped that and said, you can't say no to a population without giving us a really good reason for why you're excluding them from the trial. So going forward, that should be better. So if these weren't tested in older people, common adverse effects in older people, like falls, confusion, incontinence, decreased appetite, constipation, won't be listed in the drug information. And sometimes people just accept this as being part of aging when they're actually caused by a drug. So remember Goldilocks, not too much, not too little, just right, okay? The third area is making medical decisions for yourself. And as I said before, remember, your medical care is in service to you. So what's the goal of your medical care? It should be to facilitate your ability to do the activities that are most important to you. It is not a number. It is not a blood pressure. It is not a hemoglobin A1C. It is not a weight. It is not a cholesterol level. And one great resource for helping you think through your medical care priorities and goals is listed at the bottom of the Reality Checks handout. It's the myhealthpriorities.org website. And the people who developed this website spoke with a number of patients, family members, and healthcare providers, and asked them, what are you most concerned about when you make a medical decision? Their responses fell into four categories. How will this decision affect my ability to connect and relate to others, to enjoy life, play cards, travel, do work that's meaningful to me, learn or create new things, function independently, take care of myself, maintain my dignity, not be a burden to others, and manage my health to meet my goals, whether this be living as long as possible or living for less time but having a better quality of life. So do any of these capture your health priorities, or is something else more important to you? Identify what really matters to you, given your values and your experiences, and then share them with your providers and family. You know, your decisions are yours to make until you're not able to anymore. None of us want to think about that, but if you're extremely ill or you're living with dementia, you need to have someone available to speak for you. This should be someone you trust and who knows what matters most to you. Fill out the paperwork to name a healthcare proxy. You don't need a lawyer. You don't need to pay any money. It's just do it, get it witnessed, give it to your primary care provider, and have a copy yourself. It's impossible to predict the nuances in medical decision-making that occur during a serious medical illness. You can write a living will, you can write everything you want, but you really need to have somebody who's there, who can see what the circumstances are. So I even tell my medical students to fill one out, because you never know what's going to happen. The proxy can respond to emergent and unexpected, unanticipated situations, but naming the proxy is just a start. What's most important is the discussion you have with your proxy, making sure they know your wishes. A helpful website to go through with your proxy is something called Prepare for Your Care. So I'd like to finish up by spending a few minutes thinking about what's the right medical care for you, if you're finding your health and medical care to be a burden, or if you're approaching the end of your life. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is something called the time-limited trial. And this is really helpful if you're concerned that a treatment will be a burden. You can speak to your provider. Sometimes you can try out a treatment or a type of care and set a time limit for determining whether you respond to the treatment, or if the treatment or the dose should be changed, or even stopped altogether. For every set of tests and treatments, you can start or continue care when it's consistent with your priorities and not too burdensome. And you can choose when the burden outweighs the benefits or the care becomes inconsistent with your priorities. Your healthcare proxy can also do this for you if you're not able to. If you have a serious illness with symptoms that aren't controlled, or you feel stressed out from the illness, a discussion with a palliative care team may help. Palliative care is specialized medical care that focuses on relief from symptoms and the stress of living with a serious illness. It includes assessment and treatment of pain and other problems, physical, psychosocial, spiritual, existential, for both the patient and the caregivers. It's provided by a trained multidisciplinary team of doctors, nurses, and other specialists who work with your other doctors to provide an additional layer of support. It's appropriate at any age and at any stage of a serious illness, and it can be provided alongside curative care. In fact, the palliative care team can be a good sounding board for you when you want to discuss whether to continue active treatment or switch to comfort care. Most hospitals now have palliative care services available to inpatients. Some also have outpatient options. Palliative care is not hospice care. While both can provide comfort during medical illness, they are not the same thing. Hospice care typically provides comfort care after most disease-directed treatments have been stopped. It's really an important point. Or as I mentioned before, palliative care can be provided from the time of diagnosis and at any point, even while you're receiving curative care. The rules for hospice come from Medicare. Patients are eligible if they have a terminal diagnosis with a life expectancy of 6 months or less. Medicare Part A covers the services of the hospice team, the cost of durable medical equipment, like having a hospital bed at home, and medications. So there are no out-of-pocket costs to the patient for that. The patient lives at home or in a long-term care facility and may be admitted to an inpatient facility to have intractable pain or other symptoms treated. Now, some geographical areas have live-in hospices, and Mary Kaplan tells me you have some here in New Hampshire. But that's not the norm. Medicare will only pay for hospitalizations for people enrolled in hospice if the person has uncontrollable symptoms, not for further treatment of the primary illness. You need to know what you're getting into here, okay? It can be a wonderful thing, but you need to know. So during our time together, we've gone from normal aging to adapting yourself and your medical care to your new normal, to how to think about prevention, medications, and making medical decisions, and finishing up with what to do when you feel burdened by your medical care or have a serious medical illness. It's a lot, I know. So let me give you a couple of bottom lines. One, if you think something's wrong, get it checked out. Don't blame it on your age. My patient, Itchy, who lived to 103, when he was 90, he was still taking the subway down to his office where he was an editor of a magazine. And New York's subways have elevators, but they don't work a lot of the time. So he was going up and down the stairs, and his left knee was killing him. And he went to see the orthopedist, and the orthopedist saw him and said, "What do you expect? You're 90. And he said, "My right knee is 90 years old, too, and it's doing just fine." Another example, be sure that your doctor understands the difference between 80-year-olds and 60-year-olds, okay? As I mentioned, for adverse drug effects, older adults also can have different signs and symptoms of a disease than younger people. So my patient, Patty, went to the emergency room. She was feeling really weak. She had a little nausea and vomiting, but no pain in her belly. On physical exam, her resident found her abdomen to be normal and her white count elevated. She diagnosed a viral gastroenteritis and wanted to discharge her home. I had to explain to her in detail that the bellies of older people can hide a lot, infections, obstructions, even perforations. Patty needed a CT scan. The CT scan showed a burst appendix. Had she been sent home, she might have died. Be sure your doctor knows the difference between 80-year-olds and 60-year-olds. And remember, there may not be a cure for your problems, but you often could do a whole lot better than you're currently doing. So one last thought, as you age, learn what to expect and what you can do to optimize your new normal. Never say never, be creative. Remember that the goal is to have an engaged and meaningful life, and your medical care should be in service of achieving that goal. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Roseanne.
My pleasure.
These were great insights about honest aging. And now we have some time for questions from the audience. And for those of you who are watching virtually, you may continue to submit your questions by using the live comments section on Facebook or YouTube, or send them to our email, monlyceum@gmail.com. So while the ushers are collecting the yellow cards, let me ask this. Roseanne, since you've been in the aging field much of your professional life, and you've seen thousands of patients, has that prepared you for your own aging?
Probably not, but it's given me a couple of hints. It's taught me, number one, that aging begins at birth. So for all of the younger people that you know, they need to recognize that how they live and what they do, a lot of their things like muscle mass peak at 30, okay? Bone density peaks at 30. So build up as best as you can. The second thing that I think they've taught me is to be a whole lot more flexible. I was pretty rigid when I was younger. And it's very clear to me that if you stay that way, you're gonna have a miserable old age. I had a patient who was an acting coach, and she was world famous. She was amazing. She couldn't deal with aging. She started to get some changes in her face. She gave up. She went into a nursing home, and she had people who wanted to help her. A lot of her students and all that. 20 years, she lived in that nursing home and did nothing, okay? No matter what we tried to do. And I said to myself, that's not gonna be me. I'm gonna start trying to figure out everything I can possibly do to make things better. So that would be my answer.
Thank you. Okay, here's a question. I'm in my 70s and I still work full time. I love what I do. But my primary care physician finds it's odd for a woman my age to still be working. How do we change this mindset? P.S. I'm very healthy. Thank you.
Well, you got two choices. If you're somebody who just doesn't want to deal with it, you change doctors because you don't want somebody who thinks that way. The other is just to get them to confront their own ageism, okay? Ageism is just like we're talking a lot about racism and sexism these days. Ageism is that sense that older people are less competent or able to do things than younger people, okay? And the way, if your doctor thinks that way, it can affect the care that you get. So I think it's really important to call them on it and say, you know, you're out of step. Tell them that 70% of people who are 85 and older think that their health is excellent or good, are living without dementia, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? You can be part of the solution if they're open to listening to you. And I would do that. But if not, I would really question whether that's the doctor I would want, the primary care person I would want. Okay? The other thing you can do is realize you're a role model for them and try and get them to understand that as well, you know. But you're not alone. There are lots of other role models if they open their eyes.
You mentioned three women as patient examples. Does a patient's gender influence your treatment? If so, how?
So gender does not influence my treatment. I use three women because, unfortunately, the number of women who are living into their, you know, 80s and 90s is many more than the number of men. And so I just happen to have a lot more women patients than male patients. But I have not seen a difference in terms, you know, everybody has things that they go through as they age. A lot of women have empty nest syndrome, okay? They may go back to work, they may do something else, but they feel that loss. Some men define their lives by their jobs. More and more women are defining their lives by their jobs. So retirement can be extremely hard. The one thing I will say is that older white men tend to have an extremely high rate of successful suicide because they can't find their place. So really helping people to get meaning in their lives after they stop working is important.
Can you speak on treatments for depression as one gets older? Is depression more prominent as we age?
I should give this to you. Greg is a very prominent geriatric clinical psychologist. It is not more prominent. Having some of the signs of depression occur, and some of those are because of physical conditions, okay? For me, and I'd be interested to hear your point of view on this, it's really how the depression affects their lives. And so if people are not doing anything, not interested in what's happening, don't look forward to something, to me that's a real problem. And we start talking about what it is and how to deal with it. And for many people, we deal with it with cognitive behavioral therapy or getting them involved in things so that they feel meaning in their lives. But there are other people who, until you get their mood up a bit, aren't going to do any of this. So for those people, I do use antidepressants. I start low, go slow. And it's very interesting to me because I find that many older people, at the end of a couple of weeks, look different and are acting different to me and their families, but they don't get it. It isn't for a few more weeks before they realize that they're feeling better. Greg, any comments on that?
Well, I think you've covered some important things. I'm a geropsychologist, so I regularly work with people who have depression. And I would just say most people that I work with who are depressed show meaningful improvement with psychotherapy, medication, or the combination of them. All right. Here's an online question. What are better supplements versus medication as you age? Well, I think the intention is, are there certain supplements that you could use maybe a general comment on supplements.
Supplements, okay. So we're talking about dietary supplements. Nutritional supplements are something else. Actually, I'll start with the nutritional. If you're underweight and you need to gain weight, because weight is fuel, food is fuel. And if you find, and many old people stop eating as much, the supplements, like, you don't have to get Ensure, you can get Fairlife with a lot of protein or something, really do help, okay? And it's been shown in the hospital that people who get that do better. So that's that piece. Dietary supplements. So people, there are more dietary supplements out there than all the hands, fingers and toes in this room probably. And I want you to just think for one moment about what we're saying with supplements. We're saying that the aging process is so simple that you can replace one or two or three or four things and it'll go away. Doesn't make a lot of sense, okay? We had the experience with estrogen that taught us very upsettingly about what happens when we give one medication, okay? We don't do that anymore. Men's testosterone decreases, and it's a whole conversation with your doctor to decide whether you have symptoms that might respond to that, whether you're really testosterone deficient. The only things that I suggest people take are vitamin D if they don't get out in the sun a lot, okay? And some people become B12 deficient because as you get older, your ability to separate the vitamin B12 from the food decreases. And most people can just take a vitamin B12 supplement and that gets absorbed. So those are the sorts of supplements that I suggest people take. Other than that, I tend to stay away from supplements. And another reason that I tend to stay away from them is it's hard to know what's really in them. So there's no FDA looking at this. There are a couple of companies, USP and a few others, that at least guarantee that you're getting what they say is in the bottle. Okay?
Okay.
One last thing.
Yes.
I don't know if they work, but they can interfere with your other medications. So if you are taking them, tell your medical care provider. Okay?
Here's a question. If two generations of females in my maternal family developed dementia in their 80s, how much does this increase my risk for dementia? And are there useful screening or preventive care that can be done?
Did everybody hear that? Okay. So familial dementia is usually an early onset dementia, people who are under 65, okay? There are some that occur in older people, but for the most part, it's not familial, all right? That doesn't mean that you might not have some genes that make it more likely. Getting tested depends on how you look at the world, okay? There aren't really treatments that work at this point if you have dementia, other than the things I'm going to tell you about in a minute. So it would be knowing that at some point this is your fate and living 5, 10, 15, 20 years waiting, okay? That's fine for some people, and some people want to do that because they think new drugs will come out and they can be part of the trials. And that's certainly a reason to do that. But if you don't want to do that, the things you can do there's seven things, I'm not going to remember them all, but 1, 2, and 3 are physical exercise, okay? There is no question that people who are physically active are less likely to develop dementia, okay? Keeping your blood pressure low, you know, under control, makes it more likely that you will not develop dementia. Eating a Mediterranean diet seems to make it more likely. And there are 3 or 4 other things like that that you can do that hopefully will help. I mean, this is a huge problem, and our country has put a lot of time and money and effort into it. And we haven't gotten very far. And it's very, very frustrating to everyone. You know, hopefully over the next 10 years, things will get a little better.
Well, I regret that we can't ask all of these terrific questions that have been put forward, but thank you for submitting them. And thanks, Roseanne, for coming to New Hampshire and sharing your expertise with us. And we hope that all of you enjoyed the presentation of the Summer Lyceum. Thanks for your support in the 2022 season. Please join us next week for the speaker, Reggie Harris, on finding hope in a 5-minute world. Thank you. Thank you.